Okay, so I felt very intimidated being asked to come to a talk about seminar about cancer and tumors, since I don't work in the area myself, and so I feel very, very humble in front of the work that we've been seeing in the past 2 days. It's really very impressive to see what is being done and how complex the problems are. And also humbling to see how far the distance is still between computational and mathematical work and clinical work. And in many ways, for me, the most fun of these kinds of meetings is hearing the clinical talks, seeing what people are doing. Okay, so my watchword today is that Microsoft Word is not a novel, although if you've used it recently, you may feel like writing a novel about how annoying it is. But it is a tool for writing, and if you think about even a terrible tool like Microsoft Word, it would be awful. It's awful to use, but it would be even worse if you had to write the software from scratch every time you wanted to write a letter. Now, in the areas of molecular dynamics and finite element, no one would ever think to write the finite element code or the molecular dynamics code from scratch. But in the area of multi-scale modeling, multi-cell modeling, as you've heard in the talks in this meeting, everyone is going around writing his own code. And that is perfectly normal at the early stage of a field, the development of a field. And in fact, if you go back 35 years, there were thousands of different word processors out there. People who maybe are editors. I mean, people remember Tico and VI and Red. Anybody use Red? Okay, no. Okay. So this isn't a science talk. So you can't heckle me on the science. You can heckle me on the computational things, but not on the science, because it's not a science talk. What I'm going to be talking about is a framework for building multi-cell models. And while I am going to introduce a few multi-cell models as examples, I'm not going to be focusing on the science today. So what I'm going to be talking about is a project that we've been involved with now for about 10 years called CompuCell 3D. Its goal is really to make multi-cell modeling accessible to people who aren't programmers. And I don't think we've gotten there yet, but bit by bit, we're working in that direction. And the second aspect of that project is to try to create standard languages for describing simulations. One of the motivations for this whole project was that someone, a very good group in Utrecht, in fact, I'll show the picture at the very end of the talk, wrote a beautiful, beautiful simulation using a method that we developed in my lab, and we couldn't reproduce it. And years later, Roland Merckx came to my lab as a postdoc. He was the one who wrote the code for the Utrecht group. And while we were working with his code, we found a bug in their code, which explained why we couldn't reproduce their results. And so our goal here is to create an open source, platform independent simulation environment, and to try to separate the model implementation, the Microsoft Word, from the novel, the model. Okay. Those of you who are reading your email now, and unfortunately there aren't enough of you in the audience today, stop and do something more fun. Go to our website, compucell3d.org, click on source and binaries in the left-hand column, and follow the installation instructions. And spend an hour. No need. I know a lot of you have heard this talk many times. You don't have to listen to it. That's fine. But take this hour and try to download the software. As long as you don't have the particular computer I'm using here, which is a AMD two-processor machine running Vista 32, it should install and compile Linux, Macross, any kind of machine running XP, any machine running Vista 64, or Intel chips running Vista 32, but not this computer. I'm going to skip very quickly through this material because I really want to just give you a flavor for what you could do with this kind of approach. I think Yi Zhang yesterday talked in a good way about multi-cell modeling. The methodology I'm going to talk about is, in fact, the same, and I'm going to show you just for instantaneous review some similar slides to what she showed. But the whole philosophy of multi-cell modeling is that to understand how you go from genetics to multicellular patterning. After all, you don't really care if you have a mutation in gene X. You care that your cells are behaving badly and that you're getting a tumor. It's the phenomenology at the tissue level that you care about. It's not what's going on. DNA is just a set of instructions. Okay. It helps to separate the question of how does genetics drive cell phenomenology from the question of how, given a set of cell phenomenologies, do you get multicellular behavior? And in some ways that seems very obvious, at least if you come from a physics or mathematical background, and yet if you are a biologist, the world is so focused on genomics these days that people forget that there are cells. And I was joking the other day that I once stopped Lee Hood in the middle of a seminar and told him that he was talking BS because he was going on and on about genes and gene expression in a context which clearly had to do with organisms. And he had no concept that there were cells and cells organized into tissues and tissues did things. I didn't get an NIH grant for 5 years after that. There is a good deal of mathematical computational framework for dealing with subcellular phenomenology. You've heard some talks today in the past 2 days about going from cell phenomenology to tissue structure, but it's a much less developed field. The advantage of using the cell in horrible computer language, the cell hides the complexity of all of the biochemistry happening inside of it. And just the way in object-oriented programming, you wrap things, you have an API that allows you to communicate with software without knowing exactly what's happening inside of it, the fact that cells have a fairly limited set of behaviors gives you a tremendous simplification of problems. Now, does that mean that you don't have to go back and understand where that phenomenology comes from? Of course not. You have to. But at least as a first step, it's very useful to say, given a set of cell behaviors, can we understand how things are happening at a larger scale? People who know me have heard this heard Yi's talk yesterday, know that we are involved with what we used to call a cellular POTS model. I've renamed it after myself because I'm being modest. Actually, what happened was a few years ago when I got my first NIH grant, I got a call from a program director. He said, "We love the project, but we hate this cellular POTS model name." He said, "This cellular POTS model name, it's confusing to biologists, and it talks about physics, and biologists hate physics, and so you have to change the name." And I said, "Well, what should I call it?" He said, "I don't care. Just get rid of cellular POTS model. Get rid of the POTS model stuff." So, "Well, what if I call it my own name?" He said, "Fine." So now when I use it, I call it after myself. Actually, it's Glazer, Grenier, Haugeweg. Francois Grenier at Grenoble was the person I worked with originally in developing it. And Pauline Haugeweg at Utrecht, I think, is the other person who's really brought this kind of modeling to the state that it is now. So, reminding you, essentially it's a real space model. Take an image, discretize it onto a lattice. Here's a picture, same picture Yi showed, I think, different colors. Each cell occupies multiple domains. If you want to think about this as a finite element with a fixed discretization, that's fine. Showing a square grid, you can use hexagonal if you like. And then you have continuum fields associated with that as well. Okay? Cell-cell interactions are described via an effective energy. The advantage of that is you can write any cell behavior in the formal form of a constraint. That means that it's very easy to add mechanisms independently. This is a cell adhesion term describing cell adhesion molecules. This means that your cell has a finite amount of membrane. This means your cell has a finite amount of volume. You can add terms to describe chemical interactions, haptotaxis, and so on. You need a dynamics associated with that. We use the Boltzmann dynamics, Metropolis-Boltzmann dynamics. In fact, you can use other dynamics, Kawasaki dynamics, and so on. Doesn't matter that much. Okay. CompuCell 3D is a framework for building models of this kind. And what it consists of, essentially, is a package that allows you to specify models. You say, I'm going to have certain kinds of cells, and they're going to do certain kinds of things. And it has built into it a series of mechanisms, some of which are biological, some physical, some of which are specific to the model. Everything from control of cell differentiation, simple reaction-diffusion equations, if you have chemicals that are diffusing in extracellular space, cell adhesion, shed membrane area, cell division, cell death, secretion and absorption of materials by cells. You can do fluid flow this way. It's not a good way to do it, but it's convenient to be able to do a quick and dirty fluid simulation if you need to. Chemical responses, solids, inertia, persistence of leading edges in cells. You can do force-based calculations if you want to. Gravity. You could subdivide your cells because of this concept of generalized cells. If you want to model, for example, organelles inside a cell, you can take one big cell, subdivide it, or you have a cell which has an apical and a basal surface with different properties, cell polarity, cell shapes, and so on. Yes? You have the concepts are basically cells and generalized cells, which are everything in the world is discrete when you put it on a computer. If you can come up with a way of having a true continuum on a computer, that would be very impressive. A finite element model is also a discrete model. Your objects in this case are cells or generalized cells. Those are objects that live on a lattice, so it's a lattice-based model. However, they have areas that are not single points, but multiple points. So they have shapes, and they can change their shapes. So again, if you want to think of it as a finite element model where you have a fixed discretization, that's not a crazy way to think about it. And in fact, you could do all of these calculations, the energy formalism, and so on, just using a finite element approach. There's no need to put it on a regular lattice. The reason you put it on a regular lattice and use this Monte Carlo dynamics is that it speeds up the calculations because it makes the core computation very, very simple. The downside is it doesn't parallelize well. It works very well on shared memory, multi-core machines. It doesn't work very well using MPI. You don't get anything for free. You have to pick the time scales that typically the same issue comes up in the discretization. If you pick a discretization that is a fixed discretization, you have to use a length scale that's the finest length scale in your promo. And that means that you have a lot of wasted memory. So it's a memory-hungry methodology compared to standard finite element. On the other hand, the trade-off between memory and speed very often is favorable. Memory is cheap. You can get 10 gigabytes on your computer now. And so that's not a problem. In terms of time scale, you interleave steps running ODEs, PDEs, and the cell movement itself, and you are in fact stuck. There is no simple way to run different timescales. And this is a general problem. There are no general solutions to multi-scale integration. And so I can't solve that for you. All I can do is provide a framework which, if somebody solves that problem, we have the flexibility to include that solution. Again, I'm not talking about the science. I'm just talking about the framework. But it's absolutely true. If you want to model things at microsecond levels, and then you want to run it for a year, you're going to have a problem. And, we haven't done anything magical. Typically, the phenomena that we deal with, the individual Monte Carlo steps in the simulations are set to be seconds to minutes. And so, because the changes of gene expression are happening over periods of 5 to 10 minutes, that's a reasonable time step discretization. If you need to do things faster, then you have to move your time scale down. It's going to limit the total time of the simulation. Okay. So, what I really want to do is show you just a couple of toy models that give you a sense of the kind of questions you can, ask. The kind of questions we can ask using this kind of modeling. And I used to say that when I started out and started converting my research code in Fortran to this modeling environment, I used to say about the 10% of the effort was in writing the research code and about 90% was converting it into something usable by other people. And then the number became 1% and 99%, and I think at this point we're about 0.1 and 99.9% support. I spend most of my life as a computer science engineer. Not even scientist, computer engineer, software developer. It's really boring. But the advantage of my being bored all the time is that if people use it, you don't have to be bored doing that stuff. Okay. So I'm going to show you as an example of what this code looks like, the very simplest simulation you can do, which is self-sorting engulfment, and then I'm going to show you two things that are more relevant to people in the room. Okay. Any one of these models has the same steps. You define your objects, cells, what they do, fields. You define how they interact via an effective energy. You set up your initial conditions, and you have to pick parameter values. Parameter values, as people have discussed a lot earlier this meeting, are hard. A lot of times you just don't know them. And so you have to do a lot of parameter sweeps to look at sensitivities. There was a beautiful talk yesterday afternoon showing bifurcations and how bifurcations change when you change parameters. Those are exactly the kind of studies you want to do with a model of this kind. Okay, so let's come up with a very simple problem. That's how I got involved with this in the first place. We're going to take a tissue. In this case, it happens to be an embryonic chicken. We're going to take two cell types, say neural retinal and pigmented retinal cells, or in this case, heart and neural tissue. We're going to, in this case, mix them up randomly. In that case, we're going to bring them together in two clumps. These are tissues where the cells are only weakly connected. They're connected by cationes. There are no junctional structures. And so the cells move around pretty well. And so what the model is going to have in it, it's going to have cell adhesion. That's an adhesion term. This is the energy per unit of the area of contact between a cell of type 1 and cell of type 2. And this term, 1 minus delta, just says that's 0 inside the cell and it's 1 at the boundary of the cell. This says that there's a penalty if the volume of a given cell deviates from its target volume. And I'm now going to convert that, show you what our simulation code looks like, using what's called a markup language. That's some markup language. It's called CC3DML, CC3D markup language. And the first thing you do in your code is you say, you're using our program. POX is still there. We've got to get rid of that for NIH at some point. You say it's on a 2D lattice here. Now notice that there's a Z. You can go from a 2D model to a 3D model just by changing that number. Finite element, it's very hard to go from 2D to 3D here. it's trivial. It just takes more computer time to run in 3D. But there's no fundamental difference. Your time increment is set to be 10. The fluctuations associated with cytoskeleton are set to be 2. Again, this is a legacy name, which is going to change. And that sets up the lattice. Everything has this rather ugly name of plugins. That's a computer science term. And now we're going to specify the kinds of cells we have in our model. The medium in which our cells live is a generalized cell called medium. It has type ID. You have to give it a number because it's a computer. And we're going to have light cells and dark cells. Okay. And now we're going to give those cells properties. So our cells are going to have a target volume of 25 lattice sites, inverse compressibility of 1. In this case, they have surface area, so that's the amount of membrane they're going to have, membrane elasticity, inverse membrane elasticity. And we're going to define how well they stick to each other, medium to medium, light to medium, dark, and so on. And we have to define initial conditions, and there's some pre-programmed things that allow you to define blobs of cells, blob initializer, typical cell size, whether the cells are mixed or not, how big it is, and so on. And so that's the full code for a little model. That's not too bad. About 30 lines. If you wrote that yourself using C or Fortran, you've got about 1,000 lines of code. So it's pretty compact. And this is run using a little graphical interface. Here's a graphical interface called CompuCell Player. And this is what it does. Here I have a more cohesive cell type, which is yellow, being engulfed with a less cohesive cell type, which is red. It's a 2D simulation. In this case, I'm going to set it up so that, in fact, the yellow cells like to be in contact with the red cells, and they mix. It's a very simple simulation, but that's what that looks like. Okay. So let's build a slightly more complicated model, still a toy model, tumor model. And this is just a demo. There's no science here, really. The, quote, motivation is there a physical difference between benign and malignant tumors? And we're going to, for the purposes of this discussion, say that a benign tumor has a smooth surface and a malignant tumor has a rough surface. It's not true, but always, but we're just going to say that. Again, this is just an illustration of a kind of question you could ask and what kinds of things you can do. Okay, and we're going to use the model that everybody either loves or hates from Sandy Anderson. We're going to have four kinds of cells, normal being normal tumor cells, quiescent, necrotic, and a slightly more invasive mutated cells. We're going to have fields. We're going to have a nutrient field. We're not going to model also lactic acid and oxygen separately for glucose. We're going to put everything together in one field. ECM, which is also going to model the normal cells in the outside environment, and some matrix degrading enzyme named E. So we've got three fields, four cell types. Okay, and you know how these things behave. You don't have to go through that. Okay. And so we're going to define a set of cell properties. I'm not going to show you the code. The code for this is about 60 lines. And it would be a little long in this talk to go through it, but it's online if you want to read it. You can see how it works. But you basically are going to go through again, define the behaviors of each of these cell types. You get to find a set of reaction diffusion equations for the fields. Those are all built in. Nutrient is going to be produced by the normal tissue. It diffuses. It's absorbed by the tumor cells. We're going to assume it has some decay constant. The cells in the tumor produce some kind of matrix-degrading enzyme that destroys the nutrient, creating normal tissue around it. And there's the ECM normal tissue field as well. Okay. And here's Sandy's model. Sandy's model assumes that if the nutrient concentration is above a threshold, you have a growth rate that's constant in nutrient concentration for the tumor cells. The mutated cells have a slightly higher growth rate. Quiescent cells just sit there, and necrotic cells deteriorate and disappear at some rate. There's a threshold. And of course, the switch between normal tumor and quiescent here in Sandy's model is a pressure-driven switch. Okay, so these are cells field, ECM field, nutrient field, and MGE field. And we can run that model, I hope. This is actually a 3D model. It's on a 128 cube lattice. And this is just a 2D section through the middle of it. And here are dividing cells. Here's some of our mutated cells, quiescent cells, and our necrotic core. And I know that the proportions of these different sizes aren't right. This is just a toy model. And what you find is you get a spheroid, a tumor spheroid. And Sandy originally published and said, you can't get any kind of fingering into the medium unless you have anisotropies or irregularities in the medium. And in fact, Yi yesterday said the same thing. Okay. If you, however, make a slightly more reasonable assumption, which is that at least near the threshold for cell division, if you're limited by nutrient concentration, as the nutrient concentration increases, the rate of cell division also increases, which has to be true, at least very close to the threshold, then you get a very different response. And I apologize, the color code is wrong here. So both normal and quiescent cells are blue. Excuse me, both quiescent and necrotic cells are blue in this, black in this simulation. Blue are the normal tumor cells. And you find that the mutated, more invasive cells come to dominate, and you get fingering of the tumor into the normal tissue. So you get invasion.
What is the white?
So white is here. In this case, white is either normal tissue or space left behind once the tumor has died and disappeared. We don't have a contraction of the whole tissue. We haven't included that. Those are all things you can do as you make the model more sophisticated. Okay. And if you put it all together, you can do a little parameter plot where G here is the ratio of the diffusion of the nutrient in the extracellular environment, or the extratumor environment, divided by, reverse. It's the growth rate of the tumor divided by the diffusion rate of the nutrient in the extracellular environment. And so, in this case, you're growth limited, and in this case, you're diffusion limited. And this is exactly the same as what you'd get for DLA or dendritic solidification in the metal. And in fact, once we wrote down the equations and we started simplifying them, we realized that not only is it similar, it's identical. The governing equations for Sandy's model are identical to the equations for metallic grain growth. They're precisely identical. And if you do a little parameter plot, here's our G parameter that effectively the importance of diffusion limitation versus the surface tension. Surface tension, of course, is a real biological phenomenon. It's how tightly your integrants stick to your ECM. You can do a little phase diagram of your different structures, and it's identical to the one you get for directional solidification. Sorry? Well, in our toy definition, which is that benign tumors are spheroidal and malignant tumors are fingered and branched and invasive, the difference between a benign tumor and an invasive tumor is given either by the nutrient limitation, which is this direction, or, if you're in one of these columns, by the importance of surface tension, which is the integrin binding. Essentially, this number really here is integrin binding versus cell-cell binding. So if the tumor sticks more tightly to itself than to other cells, than to the extracellular material, you're down here. If the tumor cells prefer to stick to the normal tissue or the ECM, normal ECM outside of them, you're up there. You go up. So the most invasive thing is to have a nutrient limitation and to have cells that don't stick to each other. I mean, it's not earth-shaking result. Everybody knew that. But again, we're just trying to show the kind of thing you can do with this. In this simulation, yes. You can do the simulation where you change the adhesivity or the period of reproduction of the cells and so on. This is just for demonstration. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you see that here. Mm-hmm. Sure. You see that here. Basically, you see the lattice alignment showing up here, here. This is pretty good. The symmetry isn't showing the fourfold lattice. You can adjust the lattice. You can use a hexagonal versus a square lattice. And you can also adjust the interaction range of the lattice to reduce anisotropy. Basically, the less anisotropic your lattice, the more computationally expensive it is. So you can trade that off. But in fact, if you're going to do something where you actually care about the physical morphology here, you've got to check by going to lower and lower anisotropy lattices to make sure that you haven't got that anomalous result. Oh, there definitely are issues with this kind of modeling, but and we try to document them. Those are called features. All right. Okay. So our result is, as I say, not very surprising, but basically competition for nutrients determines the fingering of the cells. And that would, I guess, imply that the best thing to do is to give an angiogenesis promoting factor to your tumor rather than an angiogenesis inhibiting factor. So I'm not sure I'd base my... If I had a cancer, I'm not sure I'd go to my doctor and say, okay, shoot me up with VEGF-A. I should, I suppose, if I believe my results. Talk quickly about vascular development. This is a movie from somebody in the audience. And this is our HUVEC cells forming a primary vascular plexus on Matrigel. This is a simple model for early stage angiogenesis, vasculogenesis. There are a lot of models of this, mechanical, mechanochemical, continuum, and following the Torino group, we've been working on chemotaxis-based models. There's a beautiful movie of somebody torturing a dictyostelium cell. That dictyostelium cell likes the cyclic AMP. There's a little micropipette secreting cyclic AMP, and the poor cell is being teased by the micropipette. Okay. There is some interesting data showing that these cells may be chemotaxed to some isoform of VEGF-A, although there are other people who claim that they don't. This is the fundamental continuum model, which is very pretty. Basically, the assumption is cells secrete VEGF-A, and they respond in an autocrine fashion by chemotaxing to VEGF-A. The VEGF-A diffuses. The model here looks like this. Cells have an adhesion to each other and to the medium. They chemotax. That's the chemical potential with a saturation term in it. They have a volume and they have a surface area. There is an auxiliary equation for the chemical field which diffuses, decays, and is secreted by the cells. Here's a simulation. And as you can see, I perfectly reproduce the beautiful lattice structure of the experiment. In fact, you could prove mathematically that set of equations only gives you blobs. We've left out a biological peculiarity, as my friend Marcello Magnasco at Rockefeller likes to say, nature has a criminal mind. Endothelial cells have cations on their surface. They cause cells to stick to each other. However, VE cation is also a signaling molecule that essentially prohibits or inhibits the formation of leading edges in the direction of contact. And so a cell that's chemotaxing in a given direction, when it touches another cell, stops moving in that direction, suppresses chemotaxis at cell interfaces, cell-cell interfaces. And there's some experiments that show, in fact, that if you knock out VE cation in a mouse, that instead of getting vascular structures, you get blobs. So now we're going to put that inhibition in, and instead of blobs, you get a nice vascular structure. You can now ask some other questions. How does the pattern depend on model parameters? Something you always want to know. Here we are changing effectively the diffusion length in the pattern. And you see the typical length scale in the pattern actually scales with the diffusion length. And Abbas, my graduate student, very, very good graduate student, has actually now done effectively a full nonlinear theory that shows where that wavelength comes from. You can actually determine that wavelength. It's not a trivial thing. It's very similar for physicists to the viscous fingering instability. It's a hard problem. Okay. There are a lot of open questions, even in this very simple case where you only have one kind of cell in two dimensions. Nobody's actually shown whether our prediction that the length scale of the pattern scales with the diffusion length of VEGF or whatever the chemotaxin is correct. It's not even clear whether chemotaxis is the primary mechanism. The mechanical people, led by people like Daphne Manusaki and the Vanderbilt group, will say that everything is determined by stress that's transmitted through the extracellular matrix. That may be true. However, recently we've redone these HUVEC cell culture experiments with no ECM. We figured out a way to do that. So there isn't any ECM which can transmit forces, and they still make beautiful patterns. So I think the force transmission may very well be significant. Just because you've ruled it, just because you can get the pattern without it, does not mean that that's not the primary mechanism in vivo. However, it's not necessary. We haven't ruled out chemotaxis yet, although there are some experiments from the little laboratory in Kansas that suggest chemotaxis may not be it. It may actually be a direct contact mechanism. These guys are continually sending out lots of very hard-to-see filopodia that are very small, and contact, cell-cell contact, direct cell-cell contact via filopodia seems to be very important. So watch that space. If it is diffusion-limited, if we can change the diffusion constant, we ought to be able to see a change in the pattern. What stops coarsening is not clear, pattern evolution. And so there are a whole series of both mathematical and biological questions that come up. As I said, one nice thing about this kind of simulation is that you can go from 2D to 3D. The same model, just run in 3D. Growing this nice 3D vascular tree. Periodic boundary conditions, I'm sorry, but physicists. The typical scale of what?
This is one cell, so that's 10 microns diameter.
Okay. This is a 256 cube lattice.
That takes a while.
That takes 2 or 3 days to run on a PC. Not instantaneous. And now you can play more fun games. These are not great movies, but I've been having computer problems, and the better movies would not play. This is a toy simulation of vascularization of a tumor. And the vasculature in red is imagined here to be secreting a growth factor that the tumor needs.
And there also is a adhesion between the vasculature and the tumor cells that cause the tumor to grow around the vasculature. I have better ones where you actually keep the vasculature intact, and I'm sorry I can't show them today.
But they just won't play on this laptop. You can see the tumor grow.
What you're seeing here on the surface is basically a rapidly dividing layer of cells. The intermediate regime here is the necrotic and quiescent cells. And of course, as the vasculature penetrates the tumor, some of those quiescent cells go back to being dividing, but it's you're seeing a projection, so it's still fuzzy.
Now, if I assume that the contact energy between the vasculature and the tumor cells is slightly less,
slightly greater, that is, the adhesion is slightly less, and again, this is one. I apologize for having the vasculature break up like this. That's been fixed, but I can't show it. So here we have a case where the vasculature, instead of penetrating the tumor, is going onto its surface. You see the morphology of the tumor is quite different. You get a sort of a pancake-like tumor. Growth of the tumor is slower. The whole morphology and evolution is quite different. And there are some, for example, mouse models of glioblastomas
where you only get vasculature around the periphery of the tumor. You don't actually get penetration of the vasculature into the tumor.
Again, it's a toy model. There's no real science there. But you can see that by playing with that and refining it, you might actually be able to develop a model that had some scientific content. As a comment, and I didn't really show this mathematically, it's actually quite important that the cells have a finite size. The mechanism that gives rise to the branching instability that I showed you depends on having finite size cells. If you take the continuum limit, that mechanism disappears. Okay. People are going to say, well, this isn't a multi-scale model. It's just a cell scale model. If you are interested in putting in subcellular reactions, you can write your favorite subcellular model, whether you've written it yourself using Fortran or C++ or Mathematica or MATLAB, or using a standard package like System Biology Workbench, or perhaps Physiome. I think some of the people in this lab use Physiome, and the PIT lab in this meeting use Physiome. You can use, at the moment, what's called a Python glue file. It's not a terribly beautiful way of doing things, but it's quite simple, to run your network inside each CompuCell 3D cell. So if you want to have some explicit description of the intracellular network and an explicit description of communication, I'll show you how that works in just a second, you can run that inside every cell, control the cell, and build a full multi-scale model. We have funds at the moment for a complete integration of SBW with CompuCell 3D. And SBW and Physiome are a slightly competing, friendly competition, but competing methodologies. SBW is out of the University of Washington, Seattle. Physiome is out of Auckland, New Zealand. Peter Hunter. I think Peter has the biggest computational biology group in the world, I believe. I think 70 people in his group. So Physiome has a lot of clout. Physiome uses a markup language called CellML. SBW uses SBML. And so we're actually trying to merge our markup language with SBML. We promise, just the way Microsoft promises everything will be compatible in the future, we promise that our models will be compatible in the future. Here's a little model that I've been working on. It's my own science. It's not tumor-related. I'm primarily a developmental biologist. My interests at the moment are early embryogenesis, particularly somitogenesis at the moment, how the continuum structure of the pre-Semitic mesoderm breaks apart
to form the somites, which are the segmental structure in basically all animals, most animals. If people are used to developmental biology primarily, well, that's not a good movie, I apologize for that. I picked the wrong movie. If people are interested in developmental biology and they only know it from Drosophila, Drosophila and long-germ band insects do development the wrong way. Almost anything you know about development that you learned from Drosophila doesn't apply to any other organisms except long-germ band insects. Even insects come in long-germ band and short-germ band. Short-germ band do things right. Long-germ band have this weird way of doing things. In any case, here is a nice simple intracellular network. Some of these molecules people are familiar with, like lunatic fringe, delta, lint. Some of them may not be familiar if you're not beta-catenin. Some of them may not ERK. Some of them may not be familiar if you're not a developmental person. We run that model, in fact, a little bit more than that model, inside every cell. We have delta-notch signaling between pairs of cells. And then there's a readout mechanism via MASP that tells the cells how much efferin, NCAM, and N-cadherin in this case, they have on their surfaces. And so let me try to run that again. I apologize. I was doing this just this morning, and I pulled the wrong movie because, again, but that red and blue stripe, what we have here are a group of stem cells in the tail bud. Those cells are reproducing. Some of the cells become committed progenitor cells. Other ones stay stem-like. The tail bud grows. There is an intrinsic oscillation here. That oscillator, do it again. It's not, as I said, not the best movie. Those oscillations cause a band of high expression of, where is axon? Axon 2, which is that red and blue stripe. That axon 2 reads out through this mechanism, causes a change in cell properties that causes the cell to differentiate and form boundaries and create somites. It's not a very pretty movie, but you can see the kinds of things you can do. This is a fairly complicated model. We have about 30 molecular species inside the cell. They're all modeled messenger RNA, nuclear, transport to cytoplasm, translation, and so on. And that uses SPW to do the actual integration. So you can do that. Okay, so, conclusion. If this is interesting to you, this kind of modeling is interesting to you, pretty much everything that I've shown you, except that last picture, which you were just working on now, is available online. Provided you don't have this laptop, you can run it on your laptop. We're always eager to help people get started with this modeling methodology if they're interested. We just had our second training workshop in June. Had about 10 people from around the world who came and spent a week learning how to do this stuff. Surprising to me that a lot of cancer people do come and train. A couple of people doing their PhDs, one at University College London who's doing a PhD. Cancer modeling using this. And again, if you want to try it, there it is. This has been a big project, given the relatively modest scientific results. This is probably not by any means a complete list of the people who have worked on this code over the years. The guys in red are people who are currently involved in code development. And I'm sure I've left people out, and I apologize. Notre Dame has been a big contributor over the years. They're not so involved with it these days. I'm at Indiana University, where most of the code development. We work a lot with Kansas University Medical Center. I really should be added now.
University of Washington.
Funding over the years, websites again. This is the movie,
which is not using CompuSol. It's an old movie. That I think is so beautiful, Victor Steeling development.
from the Utrecht group, and it's the one whose bug made it impossible to replicate that inspired us to start the whole project. So thanks for being patient, and I'm happy to answer questions.